Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 230. What is it, Katie?
234. Yeah.
So we've done 234, actually more, because we haven't posted them all yet.
Yeah.
Remember when it was, no, you don't, because you weren't here the whole time. When did you roll in?
I don't know. I've been here for like a year now.
Oh, man. It's got to be at least dozens and dozens of podcasts.
Yeah.
Well, this is 234, according to Katie Levine, who seems to know the score about everything podcast related. We have a bunch of fun stuff coming up. We are doing a Nerdist tent at Outside Lands on August 11th. Outside Lands is kind of the sister festival to Bonnaroo, and it's in Northern California, and it's that weekend, the 10th, 11th, and 12th. And so we're going to do a Nerdist Day. So it's going to be tons of shows. We're doing stand-up shows. Neil Patrick Harris is doing a show. Justin Willman's doing a bunch of magic stuff. I'm doing stand-up with a bunch of great people. So go get tickets to Outside Lands. Just Google Outside Lands.
And they're selling day tickets now, too.
They are selling day tickets. You know a lot.
Yeah, because I think you're doing it on like Saturday.
You know way more than I do about
stuff. I'm from San Francisco. I know all about Outside Lands.
Do you? Have you been?
Yeah.
It's fun. Oh, that's awesome. The lineup's amazing. It's like Jack White's going to be there, Regina Spektor. I mean, it's like West Coast Bonnaroo, basically.
Yeah.
So go check that out. Also, October 12th, we are going to be appearing in New York City at the Best Buy Center for Performance Stuff. That's an approximation of the name of that venue. It's during New York Comic Con. We'll also be doing a ton of stuff there. And just ongoing different cons. I think we're going to hit Dragon Con. Not doing performance, but just to go. Maybe shoot some stuff there. Because I've always wanted to go to Dragon Con. So we got a bunch of fun stuff brewing at Nerdist Industries. I'd like to thank Stamps.com for this episode. They have sponsored it. You know, guys, there's too many what ifs when you go to the post office. What if there's traffic? What if it's closed when you get there? What if it's overtaken by robots and they won't let humans in anymore because they think they're better than we are? Well, now you don't have to worry about that. With Stamps.com, you can do anything you can do at the post office, but you can just do it from the convenience of your desk, of your home. You buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. You get the exact postage for any letter or package whenever you need it, so you're not wasting postage. Unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes because the internet never closes. That would suck if the internet closed, Katie. Remember, like, you probably don't remember the early days of television. They would be like, signing off for a day of programming. That would suck if it would signing off for a day of interneting and then just color bars on your screen.
That would be horrible.
You wouldn't remember that.
No.
You don't remember that?
Like when they used to just, there would be no more TV?
Yeah.
No.
Get the fuck out of here. You pack your things and leave.
You could always watch something.
How dare you be born after a certain year and not be conscious of things that happened before you were born? Damn it. Right now, there's a promo code Nerdist. You get a special offer, no risk trial, $110 worth of stuff, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. Stamps.com, enter Nerdist. This episode is Michael McDonald, the comedy actor, not Michael McDonald, the singer. They are entirely different human beings. Michael McDonald, I took improv classes from at the Groundlings like in the 1990s, Katie. And you probably know him best as from Mad TV. He played the character. He did Stuart on Mad TV, which people loved. I mean, a lot of great characters. Michael is a world-class, brilliant improviser and sketch guy. And now he's a director. And now he's doing a bunch of stand-up. You can actually see him perform stand-up in Los Angeles at the Roxy on Tuesday, July 31st. So make sure and follow him at McDonald Comedy on Twitter. It's just MC. It's not MAC. It's McDonald, not MacDonald. And that's it. But really great catching up with him. He's a super, super sweet guy and mind-blowingly funny if you ever get a chance to see him. So here it is, Nerdist Podcast episode number 234 with Michael McDonald.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Ha ha.
Vibrate.
Literally nothing. Literally nothing.
Just get you in the zone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like, it makes you go real
done. It makes you feel like we're actually recording.
And we can talk like this. Yeah. Normally we won't be able
very
to talk.
Radio.
Yeah, very radio. Very NPR.
But it's 95 degrees out here.
Oh, it's not NPR anymore.
We're just
okay.
We got book chat coming up.
Oh, I love book chat.
Also, wait, don't tell me.
What would be your weird NPR name?
What?
They always have odd names.
I think it would be like
Sarah Vowell.
I think I would just flip my name and be like Hard Criswick.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
What would you? I like how the voice is on that. You have to have. That's the book with a bookworm or whatever. He's got a voice like a bookworm.
It's like it's like someone took the classic morning DJ guy and then just put him into some polar opposite universe.
Yes.
And then everything that he wasn't was the NPR
Memos. Have you listened to Rodney on the Rock recently?
Rodney on the Rock.
Yeah.
Hey oh,
he's
I've
like,
heard
he's
that.
On from like 3 to 6 three, in the morning.
In the morning
it's like Monday morning. He's in a really bad time spot. But he's got like, he mumbles a lot now and he's kind of got mush mouth. You can
now,
really hear it.
I used to love Rodney.
Rodney's amazing. When I worked at K-Rock, Rodney's my
when
locker.
When did you work?
I was there 95 to 98.
Are you from here?
No, but I graduated high school. My family moved out here in high school, and I went to college here. So
then,
I've been here forever.
K-Rock was, I grew up in Orange County.
Oh, you did?
So
okay.
It was the thing with Rodney.
I think more people in Orange County listen to K-Rock than up in L.A.
Probably.
Yeah. Strong signal.
Strong signal.
Strong signal.
Social distortion real big in Orange County.
Take a while.
They came from there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
SD.
SD. They
call it.
They can play like a week of shows and just pay for the rest of their year. They could just do a week of shows at House of Blues in Orange County.
Yes.
And then they'd be good. They're good.
At Downtown Disney?
Yeah, that's where they do it.
So my locker was next to Rodney's, and he just had these old pictures, like just personal pictures of, oh, there he is in studio with John Lennon just hanging out, and there's Rodney and Elvis.
He was so huge. That's like, did you see the documentary about him?
No.
It's Mayor of Sunset Strip. It's just this, like, how, like, he was the guy, the tastemaker of Los Angeles and rock and roll in the States in general, and how he is now.
Yeah.
Which is just like, he's that guy with the weird hair, you know, with a little record crate going to like, you know, like Rhino and then Amoeba and then back.
Oh. Yeah.
He was a sweet guy. He really did like so much of the music that broke in the 80s. And then like that was him. He was the guy that brought
Tears
all
for
that
Fears,
shit.
Right? That was he broke that.
Did he break
right?
Tears for Fears?
Yeah.
I think he was one of the ones who got behind X in the early
years. Yeah. He clearly has a thing for female singers. It's like I listened to it the other night on the way home from a shoot, and it was just all girl rock and roll bands.
I worked with somebody not long ago who issued the proclamation that he hates female voices in music. I was like, really? That's a whole lot of...
That's a lot of music.
That's 50,
which ones?
50%.
All of them.
All of them.
Yeah.
All of them. Like my girlfriend, she doesn't really like female singers too much either. And like I find that weird.
I love female.
I actually kind of get a kick out of it.
I almost prefer
it
sometimes. Well, most of the time.
Well, because you like Regina Spektor.
I do. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Among others.
Among other ladies. You just like Regina Spektor.
I do. That's it. That's all.
Jenny
I
Jenny Lewis.
Michael McDonald. I'm sure you remember
our first time we worked together at the Growling Theater.
Yes, that's what I was gonna say. Okay, that was it. Thanks for tuning in.
Oh, it's so great, of Monica,
everybody.
To get that information to him.
That was my limited. My limited training, of course, when I was a younger comedy nerd, the Groundlings was like, you got to go to Groundlings every weekend and see the shows. And, you know, when I was first toying with stand up and going to see sketch and trying to figure out like where do I want to fall in the comedy world, improv, sketch and stand up. And I was always more of a stand up guy. But then I worked with Karen Maruyama.
Mm-hmm.
On a show in the 90s.
What was it?
It was a show called Guys Like Us. It was a you know the UPN network guys?
Remember that?
Big network that was around for a year? And so Karen brought me in to do one of the Cooking with Gas shows.
Which was an all-improv show on Thursday nights. It's been running at the Growlings for 20 years.
Yes. And they typically would have a guest come in and sort of, not like ASCAT, but just more kind of be, like, improvise with the cast.
Yeah, like, it's a mix of generally current Growlings, maybe some alumni, and then maybe a friend.
Yes.
Who is from the comedy world, but not necessarily an improviser, or at least not a Growling.
Yes. Right. And then so Karen said, in order to, you know, I said, well, I want to practice before I come do it. And so you guys had I think it was a Wednesday morning class that was a sort of sort of a pay-as-you-go, and it was for people who were in between levels that were waiting to get into, waiting for spots to open in some of the upper levels.
Uh-huh.
And so it was just a, you could just go and work out kind of a class.
Right.
And doing several of those classes, and Karen taught some, and you taught a lot of them, actually. That's where I realized, like, I'm really more of a stand-up guy than I am a classic improv guy.
What? Well, why? It sounds like what you're saying is you didn't do well in your classes with me or Karen.
Well, it's let me put it this way, and I feel like I'm a pretty fair assessment of my performance. I was able to keep up and tread some water. But my biggest mistake, which you rightfully called me out on a lot of times, was trying to, I guess it's a stand-up thing, take control of the scene and put jokes in it.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than just servicing the scene and giving information for other people to build off on.
Yeah,
yeah, stand-up is kind of a one-man band thing, and
yeah,
improv is kind of a many-man band thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
But a band, if you will.
You were a great
band. Yeah.
You were a great teacher, though, because you immediately would always... You weren't like, oh, that was really, maybe just, you were like, that was a joke. You know, that was a joke. So don't do that. And it really made me aware of, you know, like what I was doing wrong. But I think in general, if I had really loved the long form improv format, I would have stuck with it. I just preferred stand up.
Yeah. I think most of the stand ups I know don't really like the process of improv that much at all.
Yeah.
And most of the stand-ups I know make fun of improv. It's kind of odd.
Yeah. When I took improv classes, I liked it a lot. It helped my stand-up because it kind of helps you structure ideas and bits in your head. Like the back and forth that you have with improv is a good way to kind of like bounce ideas off in your own head.
Yeah,
in stand-up. You started in stand-up, right?
No, I started in improv, and I've kind of, my career's going in the wrong, I guess.
You're doing a lot of stand-up now.
I'm doing a lot of stand-up, and I'm actually touring with a guy who's opening for me, and he's a real stand-up, and he was kind of, what's this improv thing? And now I got him taking classes at the Grand.
Nice. Well,
I
listen.
Think he finds it sort of just loosens you up, at least to the concept of like, letting accidents happen, and it's not a disaster, because I think sometimes with stand-up, it feels like you gotta
control,
put a lid on everything.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but really good improv teaches you how to listen.
Right.
And be a little unselfish and service the scene
right.
more. And I think some people just sort of think, oh, I'm pretty quick on my feet. I could probably do improv. I'm like, well, you could probably play some improv games. Like you could play freeze, but to actually do a scene that's worth anything, you kind of like, there are, when I took like first level improv, and I thought I was pretty quick on my feet kind of guy, It was totally analogous to, I speak English, I don't really know the rules of the English language
right.
in the sense of structure. And so when you start learning the structure, you're like, whoa, wait, what? And then you think about it, and it's like you have to unlearn everything so you can relearn it.
Exactly. And then throw it all away. Because ultimately in improv, you kind of have to not think at all and just... roll with it. It's sort of weird. Like, learn all this stuff, nail it down, now throw it away and have fun.
I think art is that way too sometimes, where it's like, you know, you have to be able to make a still life drawing to then just break it down and make something really simplistic. And then, you know, it looks better than if someone who just knew how to do it simplistically would do it.
I think you're right.
How was improv, was that sort of a thing, like kind of sketch and improv right out of the gate when you were a kid, that you kind of knew, like, I definitely have this comedy gene?
No, I was, my family was funny, and I always liked funny people, and I liked to make people laugh, but I was a loan officer in a bank out of college.
What?
Yeah. Which is a hilarious profession.
Yes, I think the funniest.
Has anyone ever shouted that out during an interview profession? You're a loan officer at a bank.
No, probably. I'm sure probably. Usually, though, the favorites are proctologist and,
sure.
and whore.
Yeah, proctologist, whore, your process of giving birth. Yes, of course.
Anything that deals with the belt line area. But yeah, I was a loan officer at a bank, and I went to, actually a friend of mine from business school said, hey, I'm going to be an actress, and I'm not going to be in business, and I'm throwing away my business degree, and I'm going to this place called the Growling Theater that's improv. And I was like, what's that? It sounds like a terrible idea. She goes, come see this show. And I went and saw a show with Lisa Kudrow and Julia Sweeney, Kathy Griffin, bunch
wow.
of really funny people.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, that's what I want to do. And I quit my job that Friday.
Oh, my God.
No way. Yeah. Didn't even put in the 2 weeks.
No.
Well, what he did was he approved his own loan.
Yeah.
And then he quit. Yes.
You can't, like, so one of the processes.
0% down loan for $1 million.
Let's say, so you're a loan officer and you want to buy a house. What process do you have to go through to get your loan approved?
Same as anybody else. I mean,
do you have to go to someone else to do it?
It's not like I go to my loan officers and go, you know, I was a loan officer 25 years ago. So why don't we just consider that a contract? Like, you know, you know the rules don't apply.
I just think I meant at the time, like if you like you would have to.
It was the worst job because really all you did was say no to people, and it was
in their most desperate hour of need.
Yeah, pretty much. Like I had no power. It was the worst thing where they wanted me to bring people in, and the only people they wanted to give money to were the people that already had it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I gave Mike Love a house.
Really?
Yeah.
That was not how. What was that? What was that?
It was crazy. I had to go to his house to get him to sign the papers, and like in the middle of noon, in the middle of the day, and you know, I rang the bell like 5 times, and there was a very beautiful Asian lady who answered the door in a robe, and then she went to go get him, and he sort of staggered out about 20 minutes later, also in he was in a kimono.
Okay, sure.
And you know,
they got it mixed up.
I like to sign all my contracts in a kimono. Yeah.
This is my signing kimono. Yeah. It's a ceremonial ritual.
Well, they're very ceremony people. Yeah. But he was very, very nice, but kind of crazy.
I need to drink the tea from this side of the mug and then this side. I imagine that they put a loan officer in position so that a bunch of desperate people can come in and sadly get rejected while behind a one-way glass, billionaires are just jerking off.
Yes.
And just watching people get rejected to save their houses.
Maybe two-way mirror.
Two-way?
Yeah, you don't want one-way glass. And they can see.
One-way's the other way.
Oh, but there's not a mirror, so it's just hidden? Or it's just like a glass. I suppose this doesn't matter. Continue.
That was the most important part. Yes. What kind of glass? Was it tempered glass?
You would be horrible at improv.
What kind of day it is, right?
Yeah. The weather outside. What are we talking here? Yeah. Is it this, like muggy?
It was frightful.
Oh, no, I get the joke now. It was muggy. I get the joke.
Right. On Cougar Town, I direct on that. Sorry, used to anyway. And not this season, I'm just going to direct some because I'm so busy doing things like this.
Your podcast schedule.
Room bits and stuff, and one of the room bits that I would do is called the masturbating listener. So like just have a normal conversation and you know about any you know the weather any just normal stuff with each other.
What time is your flight tomorrow?
Well, I'm leaving at like 8:09 a.m.
What's the name of the plane?
I think it's American Airlines. And
I'm flying US Airways at like
have you flown before?
Yeah. I fly a lot. Really interesting. You just made direct eye contact.
Just mild information.
It's the earnest look on your face that totally sells you. Oh, really?
Yeah. What kind of bag do you pack?
Carry on. Just a typical carry on.
Keep going. Keep talking about it. I'm almost there.
Yeah, no, it fits in most of our heads.
Room bits are the best bits because it's so impossible to fit them into anything.
Right. Yeah. And they don't translate. Like, I'm hoping they don't on this podcast. It's good to do a visual hand job joke in a place where there's...
I think it still works. Right? Yeah. I think it still works.
They got it.
I'm sure they'll understand.
These are only smart people, though. Right? Geniuses, right?
It's not like this. Oh, here's a crazy bit I like to do. And then just silence.
And then you just hear...
Huh? The scraping of the microphone. But you've done all sorts. I mean, you directed a lot at Groundlings too. Did you? How quickly did you get through the track?
No quicker than anybody else.
It's like 3 or 4 years, right?
It's like practically like grad school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But everybody, I swear to God, like everybody I was with is really famous. It's crazy. Like, it was this amazing 4-year stretch of people that, like, they either are a star of a show, films, or writers, creators of shows, or something. I mean, it's sick. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I can believe it now because I always thought they were really talented, but you also just figure nobody ever makes it in this business. We're all going to die poor.
Yeah.
And everybody's doing really well. It's nice.
Well, the Groundlings, in particular, you know, obviously was. The Groundlings were the feeder for SNL, Mad TV for a long time, which you know, obviously, because you were on Mad TV.
Yes.
And
I auditioned for SNL. And
what was your audition like?
It was the hardest, worst, most embarrassing thing ever.
Really?
Yeah.
Even people who get it say the same thing.
Yeah. I'm not blaming anybody else. Yeah. It's just you stand on the stage where the host, guest host,
Studio 8H,
does.
Yeah.
You do it right to camera. You're all by yourself. It was so embarrassing. I auditioned with Jimmy Fallon and Chris Parnell, who both got it, and I knew them both. Jimmy was a student of mine at the Groundlings.
Okay.
And then, I had wigs and costumes and stuff, like trying to give them a sense of my character, and nobody else did. Like, they all just sort of described it, or, you know, most of them were stand-ups and stuff, and so I'm walking with, like, a bag of wigs down, 54th Street, go to 30 Rock, or whatever, and it was a walk of death and shame for me. Anyway, I didn't do very well, but
I think the sadder thing is the walk back with the bag of wigs.
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
Just like fucking throw them in the trash can. Fuck you, wigs.
No, the worst part is like when you're done and you have to just clean up everything.
It's like the whore, with the jizz in her panties. Like, I'll just wash these out. In the sink.
There's $20 on the nightstand. See you later.
$20.
Is that allowed to say on the Nerdist?
Yes, yeah. You can say whatever you want. All right. You can say whatever you want. We're a family unfriendly podcast, the NSFW. I never actually auditioned for SNL, but I auditioned for MAD a handful of times.
Really?
Just between 96 to 2000, maybe 2000. Why was
so between dating shows?
So between dating shows, it was around in between dating shows. Actually, you're absolutely right. And I think it was when Fax and Adam were still there.
Well, yeah, Fax and Adam would have been there in 96. I kind of got there right as they were leaving.
Yeah. And it was sketch auditions are they're just weird.
They're really weird.
Because you're dialed up to 11, and it's just like two to three people just going,
What else?
Great.
What else?
Yeah. Do any impressions you just kind of go in with these crazy monologues that within the first sentence or two if they're working, but you still got to fucking go through the entire, and then everyone else who's auditioning can hear everything you're saying.
Yeah, because all sketch characters are super loud.
And so, exactly. And so you just hear the loudest, most like, it's so heartbreaking to hear a sketch audition, especially one that's not that great.
Because
if someone's doing like a big kind of Farley-esque character, like, we're going down to the thing, and you're
it's like a special kind of bombing.
It's a soul bombing. Mm-hmm. It really is a soul bombing.
And there's like a beginning and an end to it. So it's like once you start, you're like, nah, I got to get through it. I got to get to the end of it, or else I'll get all for naught.
And sometimes they will. I had sketch auditions before where they just kind of stop you a little ways in. And they go, we got it. And you're like, we didn't get
that. But there's a really killer.
Wait for my turn.
We really enjoyed it. And that's even worse when they try and get you to stop with praise. No. I enjoyed that very much. Thank you.
But you'll probably enjoy some more, right?
No, you know what I love best?
Well, I'll just finish then.
I love that you have something else.
Do you like this character where I'm begging you to let me fucking finish my sketch?
Yeah.
That one was bad, and there were
because MTV made me audition like 8 times.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and it was to the point where when they said, "All right, we'd just like you to come back for one more time," I was like, "I'm not auditioning." And then they gave it to me after that.
After you said no.
I didn't say no right away. It wasn't like I was such hot shit. It was after 2 months.
Exhausted.
Like, how can I go? What more do you need to see?
If you had said no the third time, they would have given it to you then.
Right. You know what? From now on, I'm going to walk into studios and networks, and before anyone even asks me anything, I'm going to say no.
Gotta go.
Here's your show.
Take this contract and this big novelty check.
All right, but only to please you.
I guess.
Did you enjoy your time at MAD, or did you get to do everything you wanted to do? Did they kind of leave you alone, or did you feel like, well, there was a pretty...
It was really enjoyable. I mean, it was a dream job in that I did it for 10 years, and certainly after a couple of years, they really let me do not whatever I wanted, but they gave me a lot of say. I got to write anything I wanted to,
and
direct a lot, and I met some really talented, cool people, and I mean, some of them are my best friends,
So. Yeah.
I was ready to go after 10 years and happy to leave the wigs and the glue and stuff, but... it was really fun while I while it lasted.
And you carried the wigs out again.
Yeah.
It never ends! Yeah.
It's true.
Going down Santa Monica Boulevard.
Probably the character I've done the most is this little boy character, Stuart.
Stuart, yeah.
And that wig I used, it was the same wig I used at the Groundlings, and it was, of course, we were all dirt poor, so I went and got a secondhand wig at a thrift store for 50 cents.
Oh, my God.
And that was the wig, and then when I brought it to Mad TV, the hair and makeup people are like, you know, so we'll get a wig for you. And I go, no, this is the wig. And they were appalled. Like, it's not even human hair. It's like something horrible.
It's not
like,
even human hair.
And I just, like, I have to, it was, you know, like superstition. It was like Frosty the Snowman.
Yeah.
Like, I have to wear it, otherwise it won't come to life.
My voice gets even higher when I put the wig on.
Yeah. It ain't broke. Don't fix it.
Yeah.
But a 50 cent wig for 10 years.
I'm pretty sure I remember seeing Stuart at the Groundlings.
Yeah, yeah.
And it, I mean, just fucking leveling the place. Do you, at a certain point, is there any party that's like, oh, am I really going to have to do this character again? Or was it, were you still able to kind of keep it fresh and fun every time?
The Groundlings, you know, was, I don't know, whatever, I did three or four of them, but at Mad TV, when you do like 30 of them, and by the end of it, it was, I would have to negotiate as part of coming, if they wanted me back, I would say, all right, but I will only do 4 or 5 Stuart. Like, it had to be part of the negotiation.
Sure.
Just because they just like to, you know, TV's a machine. They want to kind of churn out product. It's like sausages or something.
So yeah.
They like something or they think something works, they'll just run it into the ground.
Right.
And for me, I had to put a limit on it. And, you know, but hey, it got me a house, so I'm not going to complain.
Yeah. That's good. And
the 50 cent wig is in that house.
It is.
Do you still have it? You should have it in a little glass case.
It's in a glass case in my entryway.
Gaze upon it, if you will.
No, it's probably in a... it's probably already eaten through by moths in some bag.
I always wonder. I mean, because the parallel with stand up is I have this bit I've been doing for a long time, or like if a band has a hit song, like we're really gonna play this fucking song. Because you have that back and forth where you go, I really want to. Maybe it's the same thing with sketch where you go, no, I really want to try new stuff, but then that part of you that is sort of a comedy whore, sort of like, but I know this is gonna kill.
I love that you're saying this, because literally when I do Stuart in my stand-up,
yeah,
the words comedy whore are attached to the whole bit. I swear to God.
In your set list, it doesn't even say Stuart. It just says like a bit about shopping, comedy whore. A bit about my parents.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Well, it's just that the dynamics, especially of a stand-up set, are that... You know, if you can kind of pull people in with something that they recognize, then it makes the situation a little more amenable to here's some newer stuff that you're probably a little more open-minded to now.
Yeah.
Because you're kind of on my side because you recognize this bit.
Well, I kind of feel like there's a certain number of people that if they go to one of my shows, they're thinking, oh, Mike McDonald, I know the guy from Mad TV. Oh, I wonder if he'll do, you know, his character or whatever.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel a little obligated to give it, but... But I sort of work it into a context of what it's done to my personal life. and so, you know, you can turn it into something else.
Which is better, because we were talking about this recently, the Young Comedian special that Dana Carvey hosts.
Yeah.
And then, like, he goes out on stage and just goes into, like, Church Lady, Garth.
Tornado,
like,
talent.
Yeah, just, like, goes into every character, and everyone's going, ah! And he's like, all right, let's start the show.
As the host of the show, that is exactly what he should have done.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than, fuck that, I'm going to workshop some material.
Then he launched into his clean slate character.
Yeah, exactly.
It's clean slate.
When it's opportunity knocks.
Oh, very good.
Tough guys. Yeah. He goes into his...
And, of course, the master of disguise.
Well, that kills. Wow. Turtle every time.
Have you guys ever met Dana?
No, actually. I have never met him.
I've heard nothing but great things, yeah.
Yep.
He seems lovely, and he's a guy that I think just sort of backed off the whole entertainment business so he could, you know, be with his kids.
Well, he had a big health issue.
He had a big health issue as well.
He's very public about it.
Yeah.
But so I'm not tipping anything, but I think he's doing well now.
Good.
Yeah. Good. He did the Tonight Show, not like maybe 3 weeks ago.
Well, he had a special from like 4 years ago or something like that. Squatting Monkeys Tell No Lies or something like that.
Did the transition from improv and sketch to stand up was that I imagine that's probably a little bit easier than going the reverse. Do you think?
I don't know, because I haven't done the other way, but the way it happened for me was I was sort of, I don't know, holding court and telling stories to the cast as we all, you know, entertain ourselves in between scenes or whatever. And Bobby Lee, who is a cast member, and he started out as a stand-up, and he said, you should do stand-up. You should just do this. You know, just pretend like this is your act, you know, that. And so I kind of, he actually made it, set it up. He called this club in the San Jose Improv and booked me for one night to do just a, you know, a sort of a short show. And I basically just lined up all the stories that I'd been annoying him with, and it went well enough. And that sort of started off.
You
like
get
4
like
years
a bug.
Ago.
You get like, did it feel like you're like, oh, this is fun. I can do this.
Yeah, it's scary. It still to this day scares me way more than, like, I don't know. You could say you're going to improvise in front of 100,000 people. You have no script, and you're going to work with Oscar winners, and we're filming it. And I wouldn't be nervous, as nervous as I would. You're going to go in a bar with 50 people. It's just you, and you have to entertain them. It always scares me more.
Where does your head go to, like, when you're about to do an improv show, like, where does your head go? Does your mind just empty, or do you just sort of feel that safety net of, I've done this 1.5 million times, there's no way to throw me, it's all going to be fine, and then just kind of go with it?
I think... usually if I improvise, I work with at least there's one person I might know or something, or maybe even a few. And generally, yeah, I have zero, there's zero fear. It's the most fun I think I can think of. If that paid, that's what I would do for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And it's really about, like, oh, you know, Tim Bagley, for instance.
Oh my God, Tim's
great. One of the funniest
people
I know. You know, if Tim Bagley, if I'm up there with Tim Bagley or any number of 1 million other people, I'm not. Not only am I not worried, I sort of feel like, all right, I'm just gonna watch Tim and just enjoy Tim, and I'll participate a little bit because he just makes me fucking laugh.
Yeah. Did you ever work with anyone like any of the IO guys, like the Scott Adsits of the world, or the?
I've never worked with Scott, but I've worked with Rich Tallarico, Bob Dassey, Stephanie Weir, who's married to Bob and was on Mad TV. I haven't done that much over there. Really, I'd love to do more. Oh, Ike Barinholtz was from there, and Josh Myers, who were both SNL or Mad TV guys.
Because all the different camps kind of have slightly different approaches to stand up, and some seem to be a little more joke based, and some seem to be a little more
character
based or scene based. Yeah. So what's the kind of underlying philosophy of Groundlings?
Well, I would say that if everyone was being really honest, that I think most of the other clubs, maybe IO or Second City, I think they probably look down on the Groundlings a little bit as being base or, like, you know, wacky or very big, broad characters. And they're right that it's definitely, we're more character-based. And then I think Second City and IO, they're a little bit more cerebral, a little bit smarter, and which is what cerebral means.
I'm sorry, I took Groundlings. I didn't know.
I took Groundlings. I don't know what cerebral.
But
I think there's probably that.
I gotta say, I never took, you know, I never took classes from anywhere else. I used to be able to, but I really loved Groundlings. I had so much fun there, and I think just I don't know why in my mind I was like, it either has to be stand up or this. But if at the time in my younger frame of mind, if I had been smarter about it, I would have just kept taking classes at Groundlings, because it really was. I mean,
training.
It's amazing training, because if you can be comfortable on stage just using nothing but the moment, then there's nothing else that can throw you. No audition, no anything else, because it totally takes away your fear of, like, I'm gonna fucking ruin everything with something that's gonna come out of my mouth that's gonna fuck everything up. Right. That just goes away.
Yeah, that's true. Although I still, to this day, get absolutely terrified in an audition.
Really? They're bad. Auditions are artificial, shitty situations.
Yeah, because you're never. Well, I don't know. It's having. I shot a pilot, or I wrote a pilot that got made, but not is not on the air this past season. So I was on the other side of the room.
Yeah.
And I found myself falling all over the actors to make
comfortable.
Hi, thank you for coming.
Yeah.
You know, like, wanting them to feel
so shitty on the other side, too.
because you, and I realize now, I think it was the most helpful thing is I realized they want everyone to be good.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have a They have a need they want to fill, which is we need somebody for this part. We hope you're it. And if you're not it, we hope the next guy. We just want anybody, you know, to be that person. And I now know that. I think I would, I probably would walk into a room with a little bit less absolute terror.
Having been on the other side of the auditions, I know that there are like people come in and right away you want the, you want to like them. And then they just start doing something, and then your mind, you're like, oh, if you just did, oh, if you just, you almost had it.
Yeah, I know I have. I've seen some actors come in and they do it. They sort of give you nothing. They don't do the obsequious, you know, like, hello, I love everything and all of you. They just come in, great, where do you want me to stand right here? Great. And they do their bit, and then they walk out, and I sort of think, like, wow, that I'm impressed by them not needing to, you know, get you to like them.
Yeah. That's the needy thing. You know Jack Plotnick, right?
Yeah.
Jack has a fucking amazing whole philosophy on, you know, on, I think he calls it like your vulture, which is sort of the thing that just sort of chips away at you before you go in and tell, he's like just to ignore it. But Jack has this whole philosophy to auditioning and it's pretty great.
Well, I auditioned for the Drew Carey Show, the pilot of the Drew Carey Show. It was like one of my first big auditions, and they were bringing us in.
Oh, you'd make a really good Ryan Stiles.
I was going to say, was it for the Ryan Stiles part?
It was for the, it was Ryan and then the Diedrich other one was
Diedrich
played
Bader.
By Diedrich.
Yeah.
So the two buddies, and I was going for the Ryan part, and then I had a very good-looking acting partner who was going to go for the Diedrich part. And I knew that he was actually one of my students at the Groundlings, and he was like this, you know, very, he was a funny guy, but also just an amazing looking guy. And they were bringing us in as twos, and which I thought, oh, great, I'm going to feel, it's not like it's just you. This is so great. We walk in, and he had a broken arm because he had had an accident the day before, and I thought, wow. I mean, I just wouldn't even audition with a broken arm. What the fuck? You're blowing it, dude. We walk in, and everybody goes up to him like, oh, my gosh, what happened to your arm? Oh, and they were giving him so much, like, just sympathy and everything, and he's like, oh, I broke it in a car door. I'd shake your hand, but I broke my hand in the car door. And then I felt the need to like get in there and score. So I like jumped out from behind him because he was like a giant like bodybuildery type guy, like from behind his pack. And I go, and I'd shake your hand, but I think you're all dirty. In front of Drew Carey, in front of everybody, crickets, not one fucking laugh, nothing. Dead silence, and I just, the sheen of sweat.
Oh, God.
And everything I said, they were just like,
Oh, fuck.
You know, I thought you can't stuff it back in.
I thought the tag of the story was going to be you saw him go out to his car and take off the cast.
Yeah, I really thought. Well, you know, I know a couple guys, and they book a lot. Like, a couple guys I know, they're comedians, but like, they do stuff where it's like, they come and they go, do you mind if I audition without my shoes on? Or like, they'll come in with like a weird hat. And like, it's like their whole philosophy is like, they'll remember the guy with the hat or the guy that took his shoes off.
Do you mind if I take a shit in the corner?
You might just jerk off while you watch me.
You do, but I'm going to do it anyway. You mind, but I'm probably going to do it anyway. I still never, I'm still not comfortable with auditions. And I was so, it wasn't until I heard Steve Martin's Born Standing Up book where he basically said the exact same thing that I had felt for so many years where he just said, at a certain point, he just accepted the fact that this audition path was not going to be his path,
mm-hmm.
and then I kind of had to realize like, oh, I guess you don't have to do it that way. There are other ways to get jobs other than just having to go in for producers and network.
Right. Well, just walk onto a lot and say no.
Yeah. Yep. I learned today.
I was snooping around your Wikipedia, and I noticed that. And this could be fake because it's Wikipedia, but you
I thought Wikipedia was all true.
All true. I hope it is because you were in a lot. You had a lot of bit parts in like weird horror movies.
Yes.
Like Carnosaur 2.
Yes.
Leprechaun 2.
Yes.
Oh.
And like what was that experience? Were you? Did you like
Fist 4, 5, and 6?
Yeah.
Well, how did that happen? Because like it just seems like there was like a huge run.
They were all Roger Corman movies.
Oh, okay.
Except for Leprechaun 2, My roommate out of college became a sort of producer at Roger Corman Studios, and I started as an extra there, and then I got my SAG card on a movie there, and then I was writing. I was in the Groundlings, and I didn't think I was going to be an actor. I thought I was going to be a writer director. And yeah. so they paid me $500 to write a screenplay for a film.
Roger Corman.
I never
before the internet.
Yeah. I'd never written a screenplay before, but it was, you know, so sure enough I did it, and I ended up writing a few of them, and they were always fucked up by the director, I thought. And I kind of thought, well, maybe I can direct as poorly as that director, who also, by the way, had never directed before. Like, you know, I want to direct the next one. And Roger said, all right, you may.
And then, that's the process.
Yeah.
You get paid less.
Yeah. Sure. Truly, I wrote and directed my first movie, and I was paid $5,000 for all of it.
That's insane.
Wow. But what a fucking crash course.
It's like school. Yeah. And, you know, I had Phil Hartman in it, Lisa Kudrow, Beverly D'Angelo, and Carol Kane. It was called How Much Are These Children in the Window?
Oh, wow.
It was how that came about was Roger Corman, for those who don't know, is the king of the B-movies. And all he really does is rip off other genres and then do the low-budget version.
And then sell them internationally for fuck tons of money.
Right, yeah. And not pay the people who worked on them.
Right.
But he said, I understand babysitter movies are doing very well. This was it after, like, Adventures in Babysitting and something like that. So if you can write a movie about a babysitter, I'll make it. And I went ahead and did that. And he said, if you do a good job here for me now, you'll never have to work for me again.
That's genius that he had that level of self-awareness.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Go ahead.
Honestly, my girlfriend worked for his son, Roger Corman Jr., who she, like she hears stories about Roger Corman and then she says, like, I wish I had that kind of experience.
She worked for the
Corman
son?
Jr., like this.
You know, because
like,
when I was there, they were children.
Yeah.
And, oh my God.
Yeah, she would say, like, it's like, it was just the fucking, like, just nuts. Cheerleader Massacre 3. And she got, like, it was like one of those things, like, we need people to fill up the scene. She's like, well, I know these comics. So she got like Kyle Kinane and Erica Costa and Matt Bronger in it. And like, it just like, it's like that. It was just like, we need someone to do this. And it was like, it was her job. She didn't know. She was just an assistant.
Just find people.
Yeah.
I had to paint a fence for Roger before I got to
marry Miyagi.
Did he make you wax his car too?
It was a giant lattice fence, and he lives in this giant house. And I was on this rickety ladder. I mean, and he's a very rich man, but he's the cheapest man alive. And I think he'd admit it. And even if he wouldn't, I'll say it. What do I care? But I was on this rickety ladder at his house painting this lattice work. And below me, I felt the ladder rattling. And it was his five-year-old daughter, Mary, who's probably now like 30. But she was shaking my ladder and she was saying, play with me, play with me. Painting, you know, almost falling and breaking my neck. And I realized I was not just painting the fence. I was babysitting a little girl. The parents were just gone.
Oh, what? Fuck.
Just while I painted. Well, I was there. But they just didn't.
The painter's here. Let's go.
Yeah, the painter we've never met before. Yeah. This 30-year-old man we've never met before.
That's like a great. That would be a great movie. Just like a weird, fucked up kind of Ed Wood movie type of thing where you're just like, you're painting this guy's house and you're getting paid $500 to write and direct movies.
Yes.
It seems like a bunch of crazy stories would happen.
Yeah, and then
right. Here's one of them. I never actually got to see Phil Hartman live. Did you improvise with him?
I did. He was actually the guy who got me an audition at Saturday Night Live. Ultimately, he was the kind of guy that he tried to do favors for people that needed, you know, help. Like if he could help you out in showbiz, he would try and do it. And he would come to the shows and we did a benefit. It was Phil Hartman, John Lovitz, Dennis Miller, and then I got to do it, and some other, you know, peon got, we were the peons that got to do it. And after the show, Phil said, hey, to John Lovitz, hey, John, you're still talking to Lauren. Me and Dennis we're not really that close. Will you help Mike get an audition? And John Lovitz goes, well, I don't know. Is he any good? Phil goes, you just did a show with him. And then Dennis Miller goes, you're still so competitive that you're competitive with somebody who's, you're not even on the show anymore. You don't have to worry about it. Just help the kid out.
Oh my God, the fucking, just that sliver of politics left over.
It was
from...
so great. They were like brothers that had grown up and still acted like they were when they were 8 years old.
That's fantastic.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I wonder. Every once in a while, I kind of wonder, where Phil would be now, and if he would have just kind of retired, or if he'd be on a hit show.
He'd talk about retiring.
He'd love to perform. I doubt he would retire. I think he would, just want to. Everybody would want to hire him. He'd probably just, do really fun things. And
House
Guest
2.
I'm sure he would have been. I'm sure he would have been in the Christopher Guest movies and things like that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was really, really, really nice guy.
He was, there are a handful of people on like SNL, but there are just some of those anchor people where it's like, no matter what was going on in the scene, that one person was always gonna
give their all.
And then sort of be the, you were always gonna like that person even if you hated the sketch.
Right.
They were just sort of,
It's Bill Hader now.
Is it Bill?
Yeah, I think so.
I think he's really funny.
Yeah he's great.
But I think he's really funny.
He was Groundlings, right?
No, I don't think so.
He's Second City, Los Angeles.
Oh.
Was he? Very funny guy.
Really? Second City, L.A.?
Yeah, remember because it used to be right next to the Improv.
I remember the Improv Lab now, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He did his show there. That's how he was found.
Are you doing a lot of local stand-up, or are you just touring?
I've been touring. I don't like to do improv. I don't like to do stand-up in L.A. Well, largely, the money's when you travel out of L.A.
Sure. Yeah.
But I'm sort of finishing up the tour, and then I'm going to do a show at the Roxy on the 31st, and that's kind of almost the end of my tour. And
awesome.
I'm excited about that, because I love that venue. I've never done, it's a rock venue.
Yeah.
But I thought it'd be fun to do that instead of just a comedy club.
Yeah.
Well, they are, yes, the rock venues and the theaters are generally more fun than your comedy clubs, your variety comedy clubs, where you're just distracting people on stage so they can buy chicken wings.
It's funny. I was in I was in the Addison
Improv. Yeah, good club.
Yeah, very good club. Very nice people, and the audiences were great. But I gotta say, as I was waiting to go on, standing next to a bus tub full of fetid standing water, I was like, that smell, and then it instantly brought me back to when I waited tables for so many years,
sure.
In the early days. And I thought, after all this time, I'm still just fucking working at a bar.
And the Addison Improv, too, has that kind of weird V shape where you're standing on the stage. There's the right side of the room and then the V part that goes all the way back to the bar.
Yeah. There's a couple of clubs like that. And you just go, what the hell?
And Addison, Texas, is a completely non-residential part of Dallas.
Well, so many comedy clubs are put in places that you go hey, I'm playing Dallas. And you're like, not really.
Yeah.
You're playing a business park.
It's a business park. Yeah. Addison is a business park with a bunch of restaurants and a comedy club.
Have you been to the All-American Comedy Club yet?
No.
Oh, that's downtown,
it's
right?
It's in Santa Monica.
Oh, okay.
San Diego. And I'm doing that this weekend, but it's in downtown San Diego.
That's right, yeah.
And they, I'm looking forward to it because it's actually in town, and you can do things around there.
Yeah,
you're not like walking.
Well, we were just there for Comic-Con, so we were just in San Diego like a week ago.
How about the Parlor in Seattle?
No, haven't done the Parlor.
Or it's actually Bellevue, but Seattle.
Oh, Bellevue, Washington. No, no, haven't done that. Haven't done Bellevue.
I've heard good things about that. I'm going to do that next weekend.
Nice. There's a you'd also probably like the Philadelphia and Portland. The
Helium.
Thank you.
I've never done either.
Helium is great. Helium is
that's Portland.
Portland and Philadelphia, and it's just a really good. I did Helium in Portland a handful of sets to get ready for my special, and it's they run a club really well. So if you're looking for a venue in Portland, Helium's a great venue. Acme in Minneapolis is great. The Comedy Works in Denver.
I did the Improv in Denver. And by the way, it's not Denver, it's Strickland.
Sure.
It's a business park, 40 minutes outside of Denver. And it's right in between a freeway off ramp and an abortion clinic.
Oh,
not kidding. It was so depressing. Sorry
the
about
magic
that.
Magic pocket improv. Of
couple of kinds of bombings going on over there. Am I right, you guys?
You abort the highway route or your baby.
Matt,
oh, sorry.
But
three things.
Boy, he hasn't spoken in 20 minutes and he's like, abortion, I'm in. Let's go.
I know.
It's one of my
go-to
words. Hey.
Matt Myra, ladies and gentlemen.
As a survivor of abortion.
I made it, you guys.
One and a half go in, one comes out.
I dodged so many coat hangers.
You really did. Wow.
Thank you.
You're a survivor, Matt. You're a survivor.
I'm a survivor.
Pay for that? No, that's fine. So Comedy Works in Denver is good because it's right downtown. It's right next to Larimer Square. There's a shit ton of stuff to do.
Yeah.
It's some rooms just have good. It just have a good vibe.
Low ceilings.
It feels like it's like, you know, like exposed rock on the wall. It's just a nice vibe. I think you'd dig it.
I love the improv in Washington, D.C. I'm going to do that in August, like 9th and 10th. That's one of my favorite clubs. It's really well run if you ever are looking for that. Smart audiences, really great room. Also in kind of the downtown area, you know.
I've heard great things about the DC Improv. I also, because I did the Arlington Draft House, which is the movie theater where they do music and comedy shows
Arlington,
sometimes.
Virginia?
Arlington, Virginia, okay. Yeah.
It's right across the river. Like, it's like you go over the river and it's like three blocks in. So it's still really close.
So those are all great clubs. Haven't done a ton. A Laughing Skull in Atlanta is a really fun room too. If you haven't done that,
I've done the Punchline in Atlanta, which I've liked.
Laughing Skull is small. It literally seats 75 people, so you do two shows a night. But there's just something about the vibe of the room that's phenomenal.
Oh, that's cool.
Everyone, you know, everyone I know that's done it, like the Todd Glasses of the world and the mayor, like everyone loves that room. Mm. Where do you want stand up to go? Do you want to do like the hour special, or do you want to do the theater?
In fact,
Showtime, right?
There you go. That's a gift for you. There's a DVD of my special, Michael McDonald Model Citizen.
Michael McDonald Model Citizen.
With a period, because I'm both a model and a citizen.
Oh, this was the show. This is a Showtime special.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I missed. I'm usually so. Oh, Judy Brown. Yeah, I know all these people. And Stu. Yeah, this is great. Well, now
you can just tell just by having it in your hand how good it is.
I'm a huge comedy nerd,
funny.
So I just like anything. I always get excited in the way of like, how did I miss that? I have to see that now. Like, so this kind of stuff is very exciting to me.
Let's watch it now.
All right.
I'm kind of gearing up to hopefully do another hour.
Wow. How long does it take you to
come up with it? I really will only write stuff if I go on the road. Like, I have to be forced. So I get my material by being out.
Are you a sit-down joke writer, or do you like kind of go up with some ideas and then?
My stuff is all story-based. Like, I guess the equivalent now would be Kathy Griffin, kind of, although I don't talk about celebrities. But
right.
Like, I don't know. I grew up liking George Carlin and Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
You know, and they kind of do character stuff and story stuff. And that's kind of my style.
Yeah.
I don't really, I'm not good enough at writing jokes. And you have to remember them.
That's the worst part.
Yeah.
I like that everyone kind of has a slightly different, you know, that's why it's always weird when you ask one person for, like, if you ask one person for comedy advice, and it's like, well, but that's how that guy writes, and that's that guy's path, and some people are better with two-line jokes, and other people have to write everything down, and other people don't write anything down. Like, it just... You just have to experiment.
Yeah, find your thing. And I think it's actually a great time to be in comedy in that you've got great joke guys like Daniel Tosh or Jim
Gaffigan.
Anthony Jeselnik.
Anthony Jeselnik, who I just sort of came across, and Amy Schumer. They've just come across my radar, and
yeah,
they're
yeah.
all very funny, very very good comics. And then you've got, you know, Kathy Griffin, who just talks about her coffee, yeah. coffee with Jane Fonda or whatever. And I don't know. I like that there's a variety of different.
Yeah, you'll like this guy Tommy Jonigan.
Tommy's great.
He's a great, great comic. Like he did have a weekly show, and last night he was on it, and like everybody was like, "Who was that guy?" Like, and it's just he's just telling, and every time he comes, all new stuff, and it always kills.
That's
just
great
rhythm, and just talking about very mundane like stuff he's going through with his wife and stuff. And it just kills. It just destroys. You would love it. Real story based.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out.
Are you still, is there any, do you do any improv stuff on the side just for fun, or is it pretty?
I'll do a Growling show when I'm in town, but I'm kind of, it's sort of like school, the school year now for me. During like the school, what would normally be the school year of like August to March or April or something like that, I'll do TV stuff, I'll direct. I was working full-time on Cougar Town, and now I'm going to do a bunch of different shows this time. Right. And then, so I'll do TV in that window, and then during this sort of spring-summer break, I do stand-up.
That's pretty fucking sweet. Like, TV directing, and then, like, on the off time, go do stand-up. That's a pretty great...
I cannot complain.
Yeah.
Is there any similarities? Is directing TV just a completely different animal, or are you able to pull from all the different disciplines?
With directing TV, you can provide punch up on set. You know, if you have an idea for a funny line or whatever, you can throw it out, and that's certainly what I do a lot on Cougar Town with, and that's really fun and satisfying because so much of TV writing. I don't know if you've ever worked on a sitcom or anything like that, but the writing room is grueling because you write and you rewrite and you rewrite, and all these jokes that you did, 90% of them just go away into the ether, and what ends up on television is a group effort, and it's not like, it's the opposite of stand-up where everything you write is what gets on in the final product, and you know immediately. This is a very much longer, tougher process. Whereas if you're on set as a producer, writer, or director, you can say, hey, how about Courtney? Why don't you say this line? And if it works, it makes it in, and it's more like stand-up.
Well, also, you're just kind of building off that idea that it's there's so many people involved in making a sitcom together. It's those rehearsals during the week where the network comes and then there's a great joke, but for whatever reason, the actor who was reading it just stumbled over a line, and then the network's like, yeah,
it's dead. Yeah, you're like, well, no, wait a minute. We can always do it again. It'll be fine.
Yeah. He just fucked that part up, but he can, it's good.
Yeah. Or like it is a great joke. The actor does it perfectly, and 4 days into it, having heard it four different times, the network suddenly goes, I don't know, it just feels stale to me.
I'll tell you what, you are not creative people, and so you let the creative people just trust us to do what it is that we all do.
Ain't gonna happen.
Never.
It's weird, because I kind of view it like, although I will say, having now been through the process, there are actually very many talented development people and network people on all levels, funny people, all that stuff, but... I kind of view it a little bit like when I go to the dentist. If I said to my dentist, you know, okay, no, don't drill that tooth. Drill this one. Like, but wait a minute, I'm paying you for your expertise. Why wouldn't you let us do our thing?
Yeah, well, I think also though, because you don't have to justify to the dentist why you're there.
Right.
It was like a lot of, you know, I mean, I remember that sitcom I worked on with Karen Maruyama. It was there was a studio and a network, and there were like five people from the studio and five people from the network,
and nobody has the same idea.
Everyone has the first of all, just company wise, they both have different agendas, and then there are sub agendas with each one of the people who all feel obligated to give notes so that they can justify why they're there.
Yes, yes,
and there, and then you literally end up getting notes like, why is that? Why is he wearing yellow? Like, why is this the thing that we're talking about?
On my pilot that did not go, I don't know if you've never heard of my failed pilot. You never will. There would be email chains between five vice presidents and 15 responses back and forth about the belt of one character in one scene.
Wow.
It's just a lot of micromanaging.
It is, and it's also...
Well, belts are important.
It's also not hard to...
Especially if you're going to have an abortion.
Better put on my abortion belt. It's also not hard to see why so many people are kind of jumping ship from traditional media and going to work in new media where it's super nimble and there's no bureaucracy and you can just go, that's funny, just go do that. And you see, you know, and you're starting to see some of the... You know, some of the cable outlets like your FXs and AMCs and people like that, that are like, you guys made this show, you know, here, Louis C.K., you know what you're doing. Just go fucking do it.
That's a dream job.
I mean, obviously not.
Another great comic.
Not everyone could do it as beautifully as Louis does. But I think the lesson is still very important of, you know, like it, because he had been through, I don't even know how many development deals and sitcoms and where they all just got fucked up and noted to death and they weren't really who he was. And it's like this here, this, this is the this seems to be the purest expression of who he is.
Yeah, I think it's great, and I think the new media the new media thing is really attractive to people, and or the cable thing. I honestly think that probably the best writing that's happening right now is going on in television. It's just films are actually, I think, more film people want to work in TV now, especially writers, because there's so many little places to do it. I mean, I know you're associated with Walking Dead, but like something like that, that's amazing that that's on TV.
Yeah.
5 years ago, whatever, not a chance.
But it's television still can move glacially in comparison, you know, like the film development process could be 2 to 10 years. You know, TV could be 1 to 3.
Yeah.
You know, but it still takes, you know, it's still, you still go, okay, well, even if I pitch a show tomorrow, and even if they say, great, a year before, like, all the lawyers do their thing, and then you go into development, and you start writing it, and then they have to approve stuff, and then you, then they, maybe they pick it up, and then you cast, and it's like, it's a year from when they say yes before this even has a prayer of being seen by anybody.
Yeah, it's pretty wild there, but there, you know what, there's a lot of money. I think the problem is it's how much money they think they need to spend,
right?
It's kind of odd. I think they feel like they have to spend, if it doesn't cost a lot of money, I don't think they actually really like it.
No, because they it's sort of the companies understand very large numbers, and those large numbers sound important to their advertisers. We're investing, you know, millions of dollars in this thing. And it's almost like if they invest $100,000 in something, whether or not it's just as good, it just doesn't sound like enough of a commitment. I was thinking about this with internet startup companies, where you hear these stories of these startups are like, well, they, you know, they raised $54 million and then they launched, and then within a week the company was dead.
Yeah.
And so my first reaction was always like, what idiots, just don't spend that much money. And then I'm like, no, that's a whole separate business where people just start things up, they spend other people's money, and they walk away with a couple $1 million. And like, it's actually kind of genius when you think about it. Like, think of how many people you know that have just 8 scripts in development that they got paid for that will never see the light of day.
Yeah, that happens. I think it's another thing that's smart that Louis C.K. Did. He said no to more money because they said, we want to put more money into this, and he said, all right, great. I'm pretending to know exactly how this went down, but this is what I've heard. We want to put more money into this. We think it's, you know, a good thing. He said, okay, great, but I'm not going to get more notes, am I? And they said, well, of course, it will be part of it. And he said, no, like, let's just keep it lean and mean, and I'll keep the autonomy, which I think it was very smart. If that's a true story, but let's pretend it is.
I like to think No, I was going to say I'm not. That sounds in line with the decision, the kinds of decisions that Louis makes, and I'm sure it's just, you know, just decades of just kind of being raked through the coals of the business, and then just finally realizing, like, I don't need $50 million. I just want to make something that I'm happy with and proud of, and I don't fucking. He just doesn't care. Yeah. You know, he just doesn't really care.
And it's really good. I'm surprised he didn't get the series didn't get nominated for best series.
Oh,
series.
Didn't?
No, no. He got nominated though, didn't he?
He got nominated, and I believe
did
also
he get writing?
For writing.
Okay.
Girls got nominated. That's awesome.
I mean, Louis. It sucks that the show didn't get nominated, but he's really the show.
Yeah.
If he's nominated in any category, you kind of go, all right, you know, it's probably hard to give him everything. And not just from the standpoint of those people going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, there really is a lot of television on right now that's worth paying attention to.
I think TV's really good.
Yeah,
right now.
TV's great.
It's kind of a golden age. I don't know how much of it's happening necessarily on the network side, but sort of like you said, there's a lot of, I'm not someone who thinks that it should be all new media, no television. I still think television is the most powerful platform, without a doubt. Still the most powerful platform. But I do think that there are ways, I do think there are some philosophies that more television should adopt.
What's
to...
What's the least powerful platform?
Ham radio.
I was going to say Matchbooks.
No, actually, ham radio is probably the most powerful because if there's a massive failure of our communication infrastructure, the people with ham radios would actually probably be the most powerful.
I had a massive thing. My iPhone is not for some reason giving me my email. Did I come to the right place?
Someone over here used to be a Mac genius.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I need just a couple hours of your time.
Sure.
Matt, I will speak on behalf of Matt and tell you that he would be happy to donate as much time as you need.
I don't understand. I'm older than all of you combined, but
you look great.
I was not raised with the computer or even so I'm a technophobe a little bit.
So you did all your loan officering on paper?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. That is old.
I was excited when the fax came about.
Oh, the thermal paper.
Oh,
the fucking
no, you want a curled flat, straight paper.
It just it curls up. Yep. That was such a,
such a convenience.
It really was. I mean, I remember the first time I saw a fax machine and thinking, society, we have really come a long way since the Marconi era. Like this, we've really done it. How is it gonna? I remember seeing a...
It can't get any better than this.
I remember
it hasn't, in my opinion.
Except, you see like those old, maybe from like the 60s or the 70s, those old Bell Labs, like industrial videos where they're like, and someday in the future, everyone will get information. You're like, what? What are you talking about? And they were like 30 years ago, they knew exactly where everything was going.
Yeah, like Dick Tracy, that comic in the whatever 40s or 30s, like people talking into their... watch with a picture on it, and that's
pretty much.
He saw the whole thing with crime trending toward people with flat heads and big zoot suits too, which we all know. Is there any specific shows you want to promote besides the 31st at the Roxy?
Let's talk about the All American Comedy Club in San Diego, which is this Friday and Saturday. I don't know when
this will probably go up next week.
Okay, so
thanks for coming to the San Diego show.
We had some awesome shows at the San Diego All American Comedy Show. I've got the Parlor, which is in Bellevue, Washington, on July 27th, 28th, and 29th.
Excellent.
The Roxy in Los Angeles on July 31st, and then the DC Improv, that's Washington DC.
Yeah.
On August 10th, 11th, and 12th.
Excellent. Ooh,
thank you.
And then your DVD, the first DVD, Model Citizen,
is
people should pick up.
I'm sure. The interweb.
The webs, I hear, is a good place too.
Yes.
Is there just any sort of parting advice for people who are starting out with improv? Just something that they should. What's the sort of one piece of information that you think people should have, like, right before they go on stage or where they should be at?
You mean for people who want to find out about improv or people who are improvising?
People who are improvising, like what's a good sort of, if you forget everything else, just remember this one thing and you'll probably be okay.
Throw all your fears and worries into your scene partner. He or she's got the answers. You'll be fine.
Oh, that's good. That really is a fucking trust exercise and a half.
Yeah.
Do you guys, I remember backstage before some of the shows, there was like some sort of like free association, like beach ball kind of
game. There's all kinds. They're the queerest games alive. I swear to God. Like, I'm a horrible. Like, I hate to warm up because it's all stuff that's like kind. It's basically one step away from camp, but everyone.
Yeah. It does feel like camp.
Yeah, zip zaps up.
I'm at this. I catch myself in the mirror and cringe.
Have you done? You should do set list sometime. I think you'd really love set list. It's basically an improvised stand up show. Where you go on stage?
Oh, I would love something like
and
that.
And they project topics in the background, but you have to do it like it's your set.
Yeah, it's real specific stuff too. It's created by Troy Conrad and Paul Provenza, and it will just have something like Hitler birthday. And
then I would love that.
Or like dwarf shoes.
My balls are already tightening up. But I love
Dude, no, it's like I haven't felt that nervous doing a show in a very long time, and it's just so much fun. Yeah.
And then so you kind of riff on whatever the thing is, and you go. And then whenever you kind of turn around to look at the wall, that's their signal to project the next topic. Yeah. And then it could be a topic or it could be like a photograph or a painting.
Uh-huh.
And then that sort of kicks you off.
And so the audience sees what you're seeing.
When you see it.
You don't acknowledge that you're doing an improvised set, but the audience knows that you're doing an improvised set.
And they see when. Okay.
It falls apart a little bit when people are like, what, this is a suggestion? I'm doing my crazy. Like when the comic breaks the format like that, it's not as fun, but when someone really is able to do it and make it flow, it's fucking magical.
Yeah, Matt Kirshen.
Really fun.
Matt Kirshen's amazing at
the
it too.
Best at it, yeah.
Cool. Well, we'll hook you up with those folks.
All right, sounds good.
But it's really great to see you. I mean,
thank you.
I love that we were able to get you on the show, and I'm glad that you're doing stand up, and now I'll get to come out and see you one of these. Please come do a show at our Meltdown Space sometime.
I don't even know what that is.
We have a comedy theater at the back of Meltdown Comics.
I don't even know what Meltdown Comics.
It's a comic book store near.
Oh,
the,
no wonder.
Yeah, Sunset and Gardner.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Wait. Sunset. Oh,
near the Guitar Center.
Yeah, I know exactly where that is.
I buy
my heroin there.
It's a good space. You just said that on. I mean, now someone.
Oh no.
Yeah.
You can just edit it out.
Well, a heroin is a guitar.
Yep.
drop out the word heroin so that the audience can fill in whatever that.
I buy my oranges.
Children
oranges. I used to do this. Do you know Andrea Savage?
I just saw her yesterday, in fact. Very funny, beautiful girl.
Amazing. And Andrea and I dated ages ago.
All right.
But we have this bit that we used to do, and I've never been able to sell it with anyone else, but I feel like you would be the guy that could make it work.
All right.
And it's a classic sitcom, like Three's Company style misunderstanding scene where someone asks you, where were you? And you're clearly lying. We each say something different. Then we each say the other person's thing. And then we combine them at the same time at the end to try to make it plausible.
All right.
So, Jonah, ask us where we just came from.
Where were you guys?
The pet store.
The
pulling taffy.
Pulling taffy at the pet store. There you go.
Makes me so happy inside. Makes me so happy. All right. Thank you so much, Michael McDonald, for being here. Twitter, are you?
Yes, at McDonald Comedy.
At McDonald Comedy on the tweets. Michael McDonald, enjoy your burrito, everybody. Ah, we did it.
Thanks.
That
was great.
Stabbing the thingy.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.